Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an Australian writer and broadcaster. He's probably best known for being the presenter of Conversations on ABC Radio, which impressively is the most popular podcast in Australia, boasting over 6 million downloads per month. Prior to his career in broadcasting, he was a member of a comedy music trio that toured the globe. Now, alongside his presenting duties, he's forged a successful writing career too. His latest book, Golden Maze, is a fascinating biography of the Czech capital, Prague. Richard Feidler, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here, Georgia.
Now, you have spent hours on air interviewing other people and revealing their stories to the world. I wonder how much your listeners know about your own personal story.
Well, I think I've often been a bit cagey about it. I have lived a reasonably public life in Australia over the last 30 years or so. But I think, like most interviewers, you're reluctant to put just too much of yourself forward. You don't want to talk over your guests. You want them to tell the story rather than weigh in. I think it's an unfortunate habit in the US, particularly on US TV, that a great many US TV interviewers will talk at least half as long as their guests and sometimes for longer. So I often am a bit reticent to talk much about myself unless I am a guest on a fabulous program like yours.
Well, there we go. So that gives me every excuse to ask you everything. Were you born in Canberra?
Indeed. No, I wasn't born in Canberra. I lived all over the place in Australia. The nature of my father's work meant we went from city to city. So I've lived in a great many cities in Australia, from Melbourne to Sydney to Adelaide to Canberra, where I went to uni. But I think, like most of Australians of my age, I think I was desperate to get out and see the world as soon as I possibly could. By the time I was at university, it was the early 80s, and you might remember we were all worried we were going to die in some kind of awful nuclear holocaust, and I had this dread that the world wouldn't be there for me to see it. So I wanted to leave and see the rest of the world as soon as I could.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that you studied at university?
I did history and English literature as well, with a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of fine art. But history, politics and English were the larger parts of my degree.
Mm-hmm. And so was it after that that you took off and went travelling?
Indeed. While I was at university, I formed a comedy trio with two friends, and we began as a busking group in Canberra, of all places, then moved to Melbourne. And as soon as we could, we got out and went to the Edinburgh Fringe in 1987. Our comedy group was called the Doug Anthony All-Stars, and we found the reception to us as a comedy group there was wonderful. It was wonderful. And quite soon we were playing in substantial theatres in London and in other places all over the world. I think we went to about seven Edinburgh Fringes in a row, I think. So that was a wonderful thing and a lovely period of my life. We were quite a scabrous group, I'm afraid to say, Georgina. We were rather foul-smelling, quite intense and confrontational in our approach. I think that was part of our appeal.
Give me a snapshot of what a performance of your group would entail.
Well, we wore these kind of outfits that were more like uniforms, and sort of having read a fair bit of a bit of interesting theory about all this, like Antonin Artaud's theatre of hate theory, we would often monster the audience. And this also came out of our busking past as well, where we would do something on stage, which was comedic or funny, make the audience laugh and then harangue them for laughing so they wouldn't quite know what to do. Often this would be in some of the most dangerous venues in Australia and in Britain. And taking this confrontational approach worked really well for us in such places. Quite often we'd often round up the entire audience and take them with us elsewhere for the encore, like into the public toilets afterwards. We'd cram them all in there while people were using them and perform the encore while sitting on top of the cubicle doors. One time I think we were playing at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London, and this was close to Christmas, and we took the entire audience into Euston Station, where a homeless person was asleep with a hat, and we got them all to throw coins in that person's hat. And I just wonder what little Christmas miracle that person would have experienced as they woke up the next day.
Oh, that's wonderful. You also did some, as you say, some pretty outrageous things. Barcelona Olympics?
Yes. Well, yes, the Barcelona Olympics, we were employed as part of the cultural festival there. And this is going back a bit. This is the 92 Olympics. And the mascot that year for the Olympics was a little dog, a cute little cartoon dog called Kobe, done by the Catalan artist Mariscal. And And by the end of the Olympics at this cultural festival, people were kind of, there were a lot of people in Barcelona who were a bit sick of all the Hooray for Barcelona stuff, you know, the way people are. And so Paul, one of our performers, was a wonderful artist who was an art school graduate. He was able to imitate Kobe's style, so he created a gigantic banner. And on that banner, he painted an image of Kobe on this huge sheet. But Kobe had a noose around his neck, his eyes crossed out, and Kobe had also voided himself from the experience of being hung. And we unfurled this while playing in the giant big city park in Barcelona to an audience of several thousand people. And the effect it had was electrifying on people. There were, of course, families in the audience which covered their children's eyes and were terribly upset. But a great many people leapt to their feet and gave us a standing ovation for having put a bit of a pinprick into the imagery of the celebratory imagery of the Barcelona Olympics.
From that, you returned to Australia and you started your career in media. Tell me about that transition.
Well, I don't think I ever wanted a career in media, funnily enough. I wanted to do a whole lot of different things. I wanted to, I found myself being invited to present television programs, and I did that for a while. But then I began doing radio. And I thought, I wish I'd begun doing this much earlier in my life. I loved it. I loved it at once. And pretty early on, as I was starting to do this long form interview program that I do now and have been doing for about 14 years or so, I found that there was an audience for listening to immersive interview program as there is Georgina. And that went against the conventional wisdom early on of the time, which was that no interview should go longer than 7 minutes. And that just wasn't true, we found. If you wrote an interview and gave it a lovely long narrative arc, you could really create something that was really quite lovely and that the audience would respond to very quickly. And very early on, we started podcasting the program. This was 2005 when podcasting had just appeared, because I was with the ABC, which is Australia's version of the BBC. There was no need to find a commercial imperative for it. It could just be another way of presenting our show to our listeners. And so as a result, we found we got this huge podcast audience that seemed to grow exponentially over time. And I remember thinking I think our boss said to us, you know, once we got past 100,000 program downloads a month, he'd buy us all a round of champagne. And then we thought, oh, well, he's off the hook there, because that will never happen. And then there were 200,000 downloads, and then it's leapt up to 6 and now 7 million downloads a month. It's been, I think now our audience, even though it's broadcast nationally on radio, I think our podcast audience is larger than our broadcast audience now, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I mean, it is extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, we've seen this huge explosion of podcasts. What do you think it is? What does it speak to in us that we're all now really, I guess, taking a slower pace of life and wanting to hear long stories unfold in audio form? It does seem like there's been a seismic shift in the way that we listen.
Yes, I agree. I think podcasts, when they work, they have the same effect as a novel. A novel that's particularly satisfying, you find once you've spent all that time reading it, it's an escape for you, from yourself. It's escape from your own thoughts that need to be thinking about what you're going to be doing half an hour from now or whatever. And so it gets you out of your own day-to-day life and immerses you in the world of someone else's experience. And you can sort of live in there quite vicariously for however long it lasts when it's a biographical program. And then when you return into yourself, if it's been satisfying, if the story's been compelling, then you do feel this sense of completeness. And it's almost like taking a little vacation from yourself. It also suits people as they go about their busy lives. Podcast is the perfect thing to listen to while you're going on a long drive or vacuuming the cat's bedroom or doing whatever it is you have to do. So I think it allows us to multitask, particularly the more banal elements of day-to-day life.
Does your cat have its own bedroom then?
Oh, well, now he does. Yes.
Richard, I'm going to ask you questions that people often ask me, which is about how much freedom you have. I mean, I, for instance, find, and here I'm breaking the rule that we both agree presenters should never do, which is talking about myself. But as we're in exactly the same line of business, I find that an interview is so much more successful if it's somebody that I have chosen and I want to actively engage with. Do you have that freedom?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, I can't do it unless it's a guest that I've chosen and who's talking about something I feel genuine curiosity about. Early on when I was doing the show, sometimes I'd have guests on that I just think I ought to talk to. And then I can hear myself listening back to them. I can't bear to listen to those interviews now because they just sound so terrible to me. It's not because that I sound bored. It's that I sound really hyper because I'm trying to get myself psyched up into it and it just sounds really annoying and I can't bear to listen to it. And I think, I don't know, always I think I'm trying to make stuff that I can just live with most of the time. So in order to talk for someone for a broadcast hour, which is how long my show is, I really do have to be genuinely interested and use my curiosity as the motor of the program. I'm always trying to harness my inner 10-year-old that is always asking, you know, why, and not being afraid to ask very basic questions like that. I have to say, Georgina, my two favorite questions to ask are why. That's a good one, you know, just simply because it's short and people give you a quick answer and they are more likely to tell you the truth if your question is really short. And my second favorite question is really, because sometimes you can be interviewing someone and they'll be, you know, giving you the same old stuff they've been giving everyone else for however long, and it sounds a bit flat, and you go, really? And they'll either go, well, no, not. And then suddenly they're talking like a more normal human being again, or they'll go, yeah. And you can hear their enthusiasm and that they're rediscovering what it is that they're interested in. So that's my approach. I absolutely have to have the say over which people I talk to.
Really?
Indeed. So you caught me there. I do. See, I'm sounding defensive now.
Have you found that in this age of COVID, it's changed completely? Again, just to bring it all back to me, I find when I'm interviewing, one of the kind of the magic, if you like, this sounds completely wanky, but the magic happens when you are face to face with somebody and you are looking them in the eye and you are having this wonderful, intimate conversation. And it's just not the same when they're not in front of you.
No, it's not. No, and in fact, my policy has been until COVID to only do face-to-face interviews, only to do them. And I've had to, of course, throw that out the window and talk down the line and find all sorts of ways of finding methods and using technology to interview people at a distance like we're doing now. But no, it's not the same. And I miss face-to-face so much because it's like a little dance, isn't it? Mm. And you really do have to be able to see your other dance partner to be able to do it well, to know when they're about to finish a sentence. Also, I find it's weird. If I'm actually physically present, then weirdly enough, I can be invisible. It's a funny thing to say. But I find someone's telling a very powerful story. If they often tell it in a way, it's like they're narrating a movie that's playing in front of their eyes. And they stop looking at you. They become completely unaware of you as an interviewer as they just tell this very powerful story. They find the flow of it. And my job in that moment, as far as I see it, is to keep my mouth shut and keep completely still so that the surroundings almost disappear. When I started doing the show, I was given this really beautiful studio to work out of. They had an amazing city view out of it. And it didn't work because guests who are not famous or who have an amazing story to tell, who are what I call unfamous, they're our favourite kind of guests, they walk into a building and they're a bit intimidated by it. They'll be intimidated by the view. So we moved to another studio with a really nondescript view that wasn't decorated in any way, that just looked like nothing, and that worked much better. So it's an odd thing. It's a paradox, but I prefer to be present so I can be invisible.
I totally understand what you mean. Now, talking about powerful stories, the stories that you pull out of other people, of course, you've told stories yourself because you have this wonderful second career as an author. So I'd like to talk first about your book, Ghost Empire. Now, I think this came out in 2016, and it is a beautiful story. It's a father-son journey, and it's all about Istanbul. Tell me more about that.
All my reading in my teenage years and my early adult life was in modern history. And I think I always thought that ancient history and medieval history was something I'd come to. I was sort of saving up for something later in life, like a kind of a treat for myself. And my wife and I had a son and a daughter, and I found our son was particularly interested in history as well and wanted to talk about history with me all the time and interrogated me for everything I knew about history from quite an early age. And I must admit, I love that. I love that about Joe. And I loved his curiosity. I love being able to tell him things and fill his head with that sense of the world and do it side by side. I don't know why this is, but for some reason, I think men and boys are more comfortable communicating side by side rather than face to face. So we do this on long walks together. And we both fell into this binge on ancient Rome, you know, following the story of ancient Rome together. And then I went right on, kept going to the second Rome, the later Roman Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, based in the city of Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. And the more I read of that history, I had a little bit of that. I did a bit of Byzantine art when I was at uni, but the more I read into that history of the Second Roman Empire based in Constantinople that went from its foundation by the Emperor Constantine in the 4th century all the way to the invasion of the Ottoman Turks in 1453, I found that so completely enthralling and found out there are all sorts of reasons why it's not well remembered, particularly in Britain, actually, for all sorts of reasons. And so when Joe turned 14, I became aware that he was moving out of boyhood and into his teen years, and I came up with this idea we'd have this father-son adventure. In contemporary sort of secular Australia, there aren't a lot of father-son coming-of-age rituals for boys and girls. We're not Jewish, so we don't have a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. Indigenous Australians have all kinds of rites of passage into adulthood, out of childhood. But, you know, the rest of us, we're a bit hard-pressed with all that. So I thought I would enjoy the last bits of Joe's boyhood by going on this trip with him, to go from the beginning and the end of the Roman Empire, to start in Rome and then go to Istanbul. And the key part of that story of Istanbul was to walk along the great Theodosian walls of Constantinople, which is still there, crumbling in parts, but still there, which is the site of where the city had its last stand against the Ottoman Turk invaders. These were the walls built by the Emperor Theodosius, and they protected the city from Attila the Hun. They were the world's most impressive fortifications. And it was the site of this incredibly epic story of the fall of the city in 1453. And so that was our intention, was to go to Istanbul, to walk the entire length of the Theodosian walls from, because Istanbul, the old city of Constantinople, sort of projects onto a peninsula, and you can walk all the way, follow the walls from the Sea of Marmara all the way down to the Golden Horn, the city's beautiful harbour. And we did all that and went looking for the ghost empire of the later Roman Empire, the Byzantium, as it's now called. That was such a joy and such a real pleasure. And to have all that time just with Joe, just that he and I together, it sort of helped us recalibrate our relationship as father and son as well.
Mm-hmm. It sounds such a bonding experience, and one obviously that he's going to remember for the rest of his life. But the wonderful thing is that we get to experience it too by reading your fabulous prose around it, as we do with Iceland. Now, this is an extraordinary book, Saga Land, because there are so many stories, so many wonderful stories coming out of the Vikings in Iceland. And you went on a road trip, in fact, some time in advance of writing this book.
Yes, that's right. I've befriended, I have a very dear friend, and we became friends, in our 40s, which is unusual for guys. Mm. Guys don't tend to do that. But we became good friends, and his name is Kari Gislason, and Kari is an academic and an author here in Australia, and he's Icelandic Australian, and there aren't too many of those. They don't have a club with a bar where they can hang out. Like, Icelandic Australians are a bit thin on the ground here. His childhood was split between Iceland and Australia, and he had this complex family story. But along with that, he also has a great love of the sagas of Iceland, and I had no awareness of them whatsoever. And I asked him. He brought them up one day while we were having a drink, and And I said, oh, the sagas, yeah, isn't that like Beowulf, that kind of thing? And he went, no. The sagas of Iceland are not fantasy. It's not like Tolkien or Beowulf. There's no monsters in them. These are stories of real people, the stories of the first Viking settlers of Iceland who settled there in the high and late Middle Ages and formed this really unique society there and brought their Scandinavian gods with them for a while and lived by that Viking honor system. And the stories that were written about them are some of the, what Carrie told me is, Richard, he said, they're the greatest stories ever written. And it's like, yeah, you know, I thought that was my friend's Icelandic chauvinism. But I read them, and I think he was right. There are many people who have said this about the sagas of Iceland, these family stories. Like Borges, the South American writer, Argentinian writer, and W.H. Auden, the British poet, they all discovered the sagas in their father's libraries when they were boys. And they both thought the sagas were the greatest stories ever told as well. So he and I went on this trip around Iceland together to go to the places where these saga stories unfolded 1,000 years ago into these faraway places in Iceland, well beyond Reykjavik, to retell the stories of the sagas, where they actually happened. And it was that was such a pleasure. That was really enjoyable to do that, to visit Iceland and be in the most faraway place in the world. Iceland to an Australian, you can't imagine how exotic it is. like there are things you can do in Iceland you can never do in Australia. Like in summer, the grass in the farms in Iceland will come up to your waist and you can just walk through them and fall into the grass. Australians know that you never do that because of snakes. But there are no snakes, of course, in Iceland. So you can have this luxury of lying on soft, high grass on the edge of the Arctic Circle, looking up at the sun, and it's the weather's still cold anyway. That was a rare treat. And this landscape, it's the most powerful landscape, sitting as it does on tectonic plates. It's full of volcanoes and gigantic waterfalls. The landscape is so dramatic and powerful and dangerous, like Australia's landscape in that sense. So that was fascinating to inhabit the lives of Vikings 1,000 years ago, and not only to share the stories of their feuds, of all the terrible violence that's in those stories, but also of their tenderness. And some of the most profound and strange expressions of love occur in these stories as well.
It's a beautiful book. Let's talk about The Golden Maze now, because this is your book that's just came out late last year, sadly, again, in the middle of a pandemic. But it's about Prague. It's maybe, could I call it a love story, a love letter to the city?
Yes, absolutely you could. I've called it a biography of Prague, because, which is an absurd title, I know, but to stress my profound attachment to it. And this comes from my first experience of the city, which was, I was performing in London with my comedy group in 1989, and we were doing a theatre season, and I was watching all of those events unfold of 1989, of watching all the police states, the Soviet satellite states of Eastern and Central Europe fall down one by one. First it was the Hungarians, then the Poles, or it might have been the other way around actually. Then when the Berlin Wall came down in 89, and I was watching footage on the BBC of people dancing on top of the wall, and I was sort of jumping out of my skin to go there and to be there and just to be a witness to history. And so as soon as our theatre season ended, my girlfriend and I flew over we went to Berlin first and then to Prague, which was there in the immediate aftermath of its Velvet Revolution, where one of the cruelest police states in Central Eastern Europe was overthrown. And the old communist apparatchiks were thrown out. And the new president was this bohemian playwright, Václav Havel, the most wonderful man. This was the happiest, I think it has to be that said, the happiest place in the world at the time. So we came into the city, which was still very grimy, still wearing all the scars or the griminess and brokenness of 40 years of communism, with the people in an ecstatic mood. And even under the griminess and all the scaffolding, it was immediately apparent that I was in the most beautiful city I'd ever been to in my life. So I was in my mid-20s, and I liked the experience of being in revolutionary Prague to being like, it was like when you fall in love. It felt just like that. It felt that same feeling you have when you fall in love, of being relaxed and excited at the same time, to that feeling you have when you wake up in the morning and you think, I wonder what's going to happen today. You know, this is incredible.
And you write about that. I mean, you talk about the city's mythical past. You talk about pagan priestesses and you talk about occult secrets. It really goes so far beyond just describing what a beautiful city it is.
The wonderful story about that, you mentioned that the pagan priestess, is that there are many cities, you know, like Rome, who have mythical founders that are all men, but Prague's mythical founder, legendary founder, is a witch queen called Libusha. And the stories about her, you know, there's no evidence other than from these chronicles written 1,000 years ago that she ever existed. And maybe she didn't, I don't know. But a great many Praguers believe that she did. And I found this wonderful story that she was known to have the gift of prophecy. And it was said that one day she stood on the edge of a cliff looking over the vault of a river and looked in the forest below and gave voice to a prophecy that was welling up within her. And she said, "I see a great city. Its glory will touch the stars." And then she turned to her courtiers and said, "Go down to the clearing below. And in that space, you will find a man making the best use of his teeth at midday. That is where we will found our city." So the courtiers did as they were bid. They went down into the forest. They found a clearing and there were three men building a house. Two of them were eating their lunch, and the third one was using a saw to saw at a block of wood, and they thought they'd found their man there with him. And they asked him what he was making, and he said he was making a threshold for a house, a Prah in Czech. And that, according to the story, is how Prague gets its name. Prah means threshold. The city of Prague, the name for it is Threshold. And what a perfect name for a city like that, that feels so liminal, that feels, I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you're going through Prague late at night in winter and there's no one around, Georgina, and it feels so profoundly weird. It feels very odd and unsettling. And Prague, over the course of its history, has been the threshold for all these kind of extraordinary creatures of the imagination. Prague is the city where the legend of the Golem attaches itself to Rabbi Lev, who was the great rabbinical scholar of the time, who was said to have made a monster out of river mud to protect the ghetto from pogroms. And it's also the city where the robot was invented. The word robot is a Czech word, and robots first appear in a play by the Czech playwright Karel Čapek called R.U.R. And in there he has robots, which are artificial humanoids that start out as servants and then seek to become our masters. And this is where we get the word robot from. But it's also famously the city where Franz Kafka wrote Metamorphosis, which begins with Gregor Samsa waking up one day to find himself transformed into a giant cockroach. So there's something so wonderfully absent about the fact that Prague's meaning in Czech is threshold.
I've never been, but you know what? I really felt through reading The Golden Maze that I had experienced it. And in fact, to quote Kafka as you do, Kafka says, "Prague doesn't let go. This little mother has claws." And I think that anybody who reads your book will be in absolute full agreement of that. Richard, I'm so sorry that my programme is half as long as yours and we have to end now. But I just cannot recommend your work more highly to our joint listeners. So thank you so much.
That's so kind, John. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Richard Feidler, The Golden Maze, a biography of Prague from ABC Publishing, is out now. And you can hear Richard turn the tables on me on his ABC show Conversations, where he uses his excellent interviewing technique to make me spill all my family secrets. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Phil McCourt. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.